I said, could you tell me if they told you anything in reference why they are coming? Now, this particular point has never been published in no paper, brought out any kind of conferences of any kind, whether on radio or TV, never been published in any book. And by this you can clinch the story whether it's true or not. And this guy out of a clear sky hits. And a man that has no education, not hardly ever went to school, he's trying to now put his little kids through school, but I don't think himself had any education. And he hits it. Well, I said, well, that's it. I can't question him more, because no man on earth would know this unless he made a contact. Because there is a certain thing that happened in 46 prior to the visitation of flying saucers to this earth in volume. There's been a record of them for the ages. Every year, a certain number was seen that were taken for this or that or something else. Only when Kenneth Arnold came along, that's when he named them flying saucers. And from there on. But prior to Kenneth Arnold, something happened in this country that our military did that nobody knows, that due to that particular phase of act, the flying saucers begin to increase in numbers and have been increasing ever since. See? Nobody knows that, what that was. And I wouldn't have known it had it not been four scientists. One from Harvard, we got their names in our guest book that everybody said I owned the restaurant. I never owned it. They lived there. Miss Wells is the owner of the restaurant, sold it when I was in Toronto. I own this piece of ground, yes, this is an acre. But there was nothing on it but the shack there, see? So, when that restaurant was operating there, these four men come in and told me just where exactly what happened. No Harvard, one Harvard, one Yale, and I forget where the other two professors were from. We sat for hours and talked about it. Even then, I didn't believe anything except that it was strange the way the thing happened, but just what might be the result in the end out of it, nobody even speculated on it. But it was very strange. And to this day, I haven't heard exactly what the outcome as a whole had been, but the increase of the saucers is one of the outcomes, because from that day on, they kept on increasing. And they've been increasing all the time. There's a lot more behind this than we realize. A lot more. And then on top of that, you see, which was a fairly well-known knowledge today in reference to why they're observing the Earth, not because we're doing this or that anymore, that is minor. But Admiral Byrd went little to America prior to war, we know that. And when he come back and reported there was ice and snow up there, and left his camp, and later when he returned, he couldn't find it. See, it was snowed in, iced in. Yet in 46 he went there, and he brought a report back saying that ice and snow was thawing. Rivers and lakes were forming, and green vegetation here and there should begin to show its head. But it goes to prove, beyond the shadow of the doubt, that there had been a shift to the Earth on its axis. Well, any shift of any planet in a system, like a solar system, will naturally change the ordination of relationship between two bodies. And if they are advanced as far as we assume they are, and now we begin to realize that they are, they will detect that. We have instruments, they naturally would probably have better ones. All right, they were detected, wondering what has taken place. Because any shift of any body in a system like that would be just like a spoke in a wheel. If it shifts out from its proper position, it throws the wheel off balance. There's an adjustment that must take place before that wheel is going to be running on even keel. Well, that's the major thing they're looking for. They were observing that. The shift is still continuing. And even not long ago, our papers down here in San Diego carried a certain percentage of that shift, which I doubted is that far, because that far we'd be noticing a lot worse condition than we do. But they have at least said that, admitting that there's a shift continuing. Just how far it's going to go is hard to say. And the analysis on the shift, if it is true, as some of the scientists are proposing, the idea that it's 26,000-year cycle is ending and will reverse the whole plan here, I don't know where they get it, because we have no record of 26,000 years. I don't think we have. Maybe we have some way, but I don't think so. I have never heard about it. Then, naturally, if we go along the lines of history, and the only place we can go to is the biblical history. Well, in the history there, and we take a Noah's flood into consideration on that base, that's the only thing we can bank on. Well, we do know that the firmament was heavy, what they call the overcast today, after that flood. It was a steady cast of clouds where the sun had not been seen for years and years. Well, Naturally, if a soil is waterlogged, it's going to take a long time to evaporate, and all that evaporation is going to create clouds in there. And you go back to that type of a history, you will find that they have lived long life at that time, say around 1,000 years, Methuselah supposed to have been. Well, we do know that the cosmic ray, as science tells us today, does carry the gamma ray with it. And the gamma ray is not healthy for any human body. And if you go back to that history, when that firmament, so-called, burned away, as a fog burns away, it's from there on that you can trace how the span of light began to descend. Yeah. So it shows a pretty good indication there just what might be happening if this is the same condition should come up on us again. If the earth is shifting, it may shift to a position that finally will tilt into one quarter of it go underwater, the other quarter that's been 70-some-odd thousand years underwater will come up. And actually, would restore the same condition that existed after Noah's time, which is a firmament again, as they call it then, and it'd be an ice age in the extreme part of that section, while in the territory that remains dry would become a tropical situation, see? Mm-hmm. And cloud formations that would steadily be over the earth then, that existed then, with no doubt in my mind, would produce what we might call a healthy situation. And the gamma ray is the deadly ray that causes to go down, because it would be filtered through the cloud system, which it was before. That's only but logic. That's only speculating on what can take place. And yet, most of your scientists that do come out along that line seem to go all the way, but just when?
Yeah.
Maybe 5 minutes, 5 hours, or 5,000 years from now. But it is moving that way.
Now, did you get a cigarette?
Yes, sir.
Is that the same? Is this the same thing now that Mr. Van Tassel talks about? His polar flip. This.
I'll be honest with you. I don't know what Van Tassel is talking about. I really don't. He's got a square moon and all that stuff, which doesn't make sense. The unfortunate part in this whole situation is that so many of those fellows are trying to throw the thing into some occult field.
Yeah.
Which just doesn't belong to really nobody. It belongs to the world if it belongs to anybody. It's the whole world is affected, and that's why I can't go along with any of those fellas.
Van Tassel, and of course, now this Fry is, he doesn't go along with it too much, does he, or does he?
Well, he didn't at first, but on this convention that day when he talked there, he had a tendency to swing their way. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what's the score.
I see.
I didn't. I just held to the ground and let it stay there. That's where it belonged. Although I could have got into the other field, because I have been confronted with a man, might be called a topsman, of the Bishop of Canterbury, right here in that chair. Come down here to find out what the relationships are in reference to religion. That's their major idea. I've been confronted on the same grounds with the Catholics. I've been confronted on the same grounds with the Christ Council of Churches. So they are interested,
see,
and they think it's urgent. They really do, at least what they have said. So I do know that all the peoples are interested in the situation. And I do know, regardless how much fun we try to make out of the deal, there's no fun in it. It's more serious than we realize. Because we can trace it back a little bit. Those things have happened before. And as I have an article there, Dr. Hubble admitted in 52 in Philadelphia to a philosophical society that we have already discovered between 1 to 3 sextillion what we call stars commonly. And he admits in there, point blank, that's with the 100-inch, point blank, that there must be duplicates of our Earth somewhere out there with the same climate, same minerals, same everything. He tells you that much. See? And then he goes on and calculates these 1 to 3 sextillion bodies out there, telling you point blank again that they're all made up, apparently the same type of mineral that Mother Earth has. If we take chemistry into consideration, which we must, I do acknowledge God. I believe there's a supreme being governs the whole thing. No man can deny that, because he's subject unto some powers all the time. Okay, so we acknowledge that part. But we also can go back and say that this earth has its beginning sometime too, as it's going to have its ending, as any form has. So all we can do is speculate on. We weren't here to see it when it happened. But we have a pretty good idea as how it might have happened. And that might, so long as it's logical and sensible, it can prove. prove his point to a certain extent. We do know that space is full of space debris. Particles of dust are flying through space constantly. We could not take a ship out from here 25,000 miles per hour to the moon without being sandpapered.
Yeah, sure.
We know that. All right. Those particles are minute, cannot be seen by a naked eye. Yet sometimes, somewhere, they must in some way or another associate with one another. Once two particles associate with one another, what happens? They have all taken on a different law by weight. They become the masters of all singulars out there and begin to attract onto themselves, just like a one flake of snow that fell and started rolling quickly instead of dropping laying there, but started rolling over the snow that's fallen. By the time it got to a block or two, it'd be a massive ball. Each time it gets bigger, the compression towards the center would be greater. See? All right. You might visualize it the same way in the making of the earth. Well, in those minute particles must have been everything. Like we say, there must have been a potential or a seed for a blade of grass to later be grown out of that body. The worm and things like that must have been there in a minute form, or it couldn't have never grown, chemically speaking. So once the thing solidified in that manner, which took maybe thousands and millions of years to do before it became a size ball like we know the earth to be, combustion through compression must take place in the center of the earth. That's why you say the earth is hotter than the center. Well, naturally, softest elements, so to speak, like metals, softest elements will begin to melt first under the lightest heat. And those are gold and silver and stuff like that. We today mine, we find veins. The veins are not just veins in there because they grow that way, they flow on that way. When they were in liquid form, when the cavity began to form, and the gases naturally had to escape, condensation was taking place in some degree, that water formation began to take place, and the other gases escaped through the pores of this, I call it, ball-headed earth. It had to, because there's nothing so solid as what's not porous. And the pressure too intense pushed itself out, and the ball-headed earth, for the first time, starts sweating. What do we call it? Sweat. And as it starts sweating, the more sweat come out of there, the greater the boiling pot was going on there, and things taking place within the center of the earth, the greater amount of it, through its revolving, began to evaporate into space, which finally created the clouds that did not exist there before. See? Till it finally was not moisture up there, that finally had to come back and fall back, first rain. And even the evidence are showing here that the dinosaur, which was in the early days, the vegetarian, was a big monster that eat up tons upon tons of vegetation per day. He had to do that. And in order to keep the atmosphere clear from poison, if all of that had fallen back to decay, our atmosphere would have been poisoned, not suitable for human beings. But after it's mild down and got to normalcy, then notice the dinosaur vanishes and the smaller animals come in when things begin to take on order. That's the only way I can see this whole thing has happened. And it happened the same way on other planets. And we take our Earth into consideration, see what it has reproduced. All right, we take a system, like a solar system of ours, isolated from the rest of space. Like we isolate an ocean from an ocean. Anything that's born within that system, then, must be born of the same elements. Then it should reproduce the like our planet did. Yeah. Our planet is only minor one in comparison to the others. So if ours reproduced what it did, the others must have reproduced the like. The society are set up in a situation in there. Sure, we have such a conditions in this world. We have conditions in this world. We find that some part of the world, civilization, has learned certain things and are tops in it. While another one is doing something else and are tops in it. We have learned what we have learned, begin to tops in the world, mechanically and advanced beyond all the nations of the world. See? Yet it's one same world. You might lay that out into a system of planets the same way. So there'd be some advanced ahead of us, some maybe not as far as us. We're not the poorest, but we're not the best either. See? You got to look at the picture straight. And we ourselves are actually planning to go to the planet Mars or Venus. And I am sure that we are blessed without a war for a while, say for the next 10 years, that we will do it.
Well, I'm firmly convinced.
Yeah, well, we will do it. We're almost on top of it now. And the only thing we'll have to change, and I've already talked to some individuals from the conveyor that have much on the drawing board in that line already, and probably even further than that. But there's only one thing we have to learn, and we have to learn it before we can make a successful flight to any planet. even outside of our own system. And that is, we have to give up aerodynamics of present day and go back to new line altogether. Because in aerodynamics, we work on stresses, all sorts of things like that. And we have to build our ships accordingly. All right? But in nature, as far as the Earth is concerned, there is no such a thing. And I have found out that these people that operate these ships, and they're people like ourselves, whether people believe it or not, eventually some of these days they're all going to see them. All right. Are people that have asked this question at one time, as we should have asked. Well, the Earth is revolving at 18.5 miles per second, steadily. We don't even know we're moving. What makes this Earth move on its orbit? Not only is it moving in its orbit, but it's also moving on a 24-hour basis and then orbit of 365 days in the meantime wobble stage. Three stages. And it's operating in three stages. Yet we know nothing about it. We're living right on it. In other words, we're really riding a spaceship. That so-called nature mill. See? At 18.5 thousand miles per second. We're riding that. And don't know a thing about it. So, there's your clue. They have asked that question. No jet engine like we say it today. No wings on it. What makes it move? They start investigating. Maybe we can build a satellite, what we call it today, a satellite, that'll operate the same way only man's made. And they have succeeded in that. So there's really no mystery involved. When they make those turns, the Earth makes certain turns too. We don't know none about it. Why? If the Earth was to stop this very moment, I doubt what any one of us would know what happened. Because the air, what we call the atmosphere, would be gone just that fast. It'd be gone just that fast. And we die of the lack of air. And if it continued to stay standing still, then the energy within the Earth itself would exert itself to start breaking it up. Just like a pilot may go up so high without a pressurized ship and lighter air, he hasn't got the support for his body from the outside no more and begins to expand. The same idea. Okay, so what they have really learned is this. They utilize this magnetic force, as they call it magnetic force, in our early days, it was known kinetic electricity, producing our lightning. We must admit that when there's a flash of lightning for 2-3 hours going on like it does in California sometime, and I've seen last year, very remarkably, that only all the power plants hooked together would only produce one flash like that, and that would be the end of the power. Yet here it goes on for hours. There's plenty of it there. Okay. They realize that. They hooked onto that power. So they have power wherever they want to go. They have excess power to this point. They only utilize 10% for propulsion. 90% they must dissipate. What do? They dissipate it from the skin of the ship. See, what we call the skin of the ship, the surface. All particles in space are negative to space. Space is positive. So all particles that would otherwise hit that ship or the body of the ship are repelled by the negative radiation from the skin of the ship. The negative repels the negative. So they never touch anything, even a meteorite. Because what they have actually produced through this dissipation of this excess power is produced an atmosphere around themselves, own gravitational field, in a wavelength system, like you drop a pebble in a still pool of water, and you see wavelength after wavelength going out, you can assure yourself one thing, that if you can measure it correctly, you will find that your ship is pressurized, according to our law, at 14.7 inside, that the first wavelength radiating from the skin of the ship is also 14.7. It's from there on she begins to descend. See? And when they see trails of these things, and see sometimes sparks flying behind, it's not coming from the ship. Maybe that radiation is extending 50 miles, 100, 250 miles away from the body of the ship. And it's there where the fringe of it is that comes in contact with the fringe of space, or space itself, or our own. See? And that's where the friction is set up. So the ship is right in Kugel, right on through. They don't even know when to make a turn. I usually use this illustration in an explanation. You take an egg. Everybody knows what an egg is like. All right? The yolk of an egg is the solid part of that egg. The viewer or the white of an egg is just like air would be around the earth. All right? The shell of the egg is the fringe of the egg, which is the crust. If we were to put a man on the yolk of an egg, he is submerged in the white of an egg, is he not? Then we throw him. Throw the whole world. Would he know he'd be thrown? No. Because the fringe, the friction and everything would be on that on the extreme part of the egg, which is the shell of the egg. The inside of the egg wouldn't know a damn thing about it. Well, just that's just what exactly they done, which the earth is doing every day. You see?
But, this idea, the thing that I've always wondered about on this is the shape of these saucers. Why the saucer shape? What do they...
You see, they don't have to make a turn.
I see.
In other words, their false-type landing gears, as they call them, or they've been called, are only landing gears in emergency. They are actually condensers for condensing static electricity. And static electricity, we already know in a military setup, that once you load a ball, hollow ball of static electricity, the darn things start floating up. See? All right. So they're condensers. The ship, they can cut one off or the other. See? Whichever they cut off, that's the way the ship is going to go. They don't have to make a turn as we do with an R automobile or our ships. They just swing either go this way, or that way. It doesn't make no difference. To us, it looks like make right angle turns, but they don't.
I see.
They really don't. It's very funny. You see, Captain Mantell got caught. He would have never got hurt had the ship been a fuselage alone without the wings. Because you like taking two bars of names, I think I've got some negatives here. I'll show you. Yeah, and two bars of magnets. They're on the like. So they attract just like that. That's what would have happened. But having a wing, you were caught this way, start twisting the wing. You got caught in this power that was radiating, protecting the major ship, this radiation they're all talking about, repelling force. He got pulled in by the wing and start twisting. Well, once the wing got caught, the whole thing started breaking up. The wing was the first thing would break off. That's where that trouble was. Otherwise, if he had a fuselage or cigar-shaped type ship or anything like that, it would have just come together like the two bars do and nothing would have happened. Because they can do that very easily. They really, you might say, didn't mean to harm nobody. He just didn't know it and he got in too close like we used to hit supersonic walls before we know how to penetrate them. It was not a supersonic wall that wanted to kill us.
Yeah.
We just didn't know any better. We didn't see it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened there. But you see, the thing is running in parallel lines all the time. Anything that comes in this way, towards center especially of a ship, because the center part is positive, see? You see your magnets, if you take your magnets, they radiate from the ends towards center. Some all the way around. Well, I always even question this now, I begin to question since I've learned how they do things, and that is, they say that our Earth, North Pole, South Pole. I wonder if there is one such a thing. Because one would be negative and the other be positive. Wouldn't that be true? According to our magnetic law. Yet, I say the center of the Earth is positive, so both ends must be negative instead of one positive and negative. Because the forces working this way.
Yeah, that's it to me, yeah.
Fellow. But here's the point. I don't know if you got into the psychic field thing or not. Have you?
No, I never have.
I mean, listen to some of it.
Yeah, I've listened to some of it.
You have? Well, that's the main thing. Let us get down to common sense. We don't want to get fooled. And I think our government deserves all the true information of a clear-cut nature that is possible to get. Because the better we are informed, the better we are fitted for anything that might come. And that is, we must admit that a human being is a strange animal. He is made up of every element known on Earth, as well as in space, because he breathes. Therefore, he would automatically be a potential for feeling or vibrations or frequencies that alert him to certain conditions from the lowest stage of mineral action to the highest stage of intelligence. Would that?
Mm-hmm.
All right, now. That would then call for quite a study of oneself to be able to tell definitely is from what angle he's getting his information, from what source.
Yeah.
That we have not done. Then you cannot, as much as you would like to support everybody, you just can't do it. So long as you know that the individual has not been so alerted that he is a potential for such a case.
Yeah. Well, the only thing is that I read Williamson's book, I read parts of it, and the only thing that I didn't like in the book was his business about the Ouija board.
That's it. That's another one. I have always heard, although I can say with pride, today, that at the convention, Lady by Barry Stone come up, and she says to me, George, we've been playing around with the Ouija board. I says, forget it, drop it. You can go even nuts on it. I said it right to her. Drop it. You've got to learn things more, know more about things before you can even start tackling it. I'm not denying it. Every person has a right of their own, and I'm not taking any right from you or anything like that, but you don't know enough about it, let it alone. You can get in much confusion and get yourself in a mess that you won't know where you're at. Dr. Williamson stood right by me, and he says, yes, drop it. He says, if I had listened to George, I wouldn't have gotten in the mess either. I now realize what he tried to tell me. But you see, nobody's trying to listen to you. Think that you're trying to dominate them or something else. Yeah. When you try to correct them. Sure, if you charge them $25 for a lesson, oh, they'll grab it and pay for it and try to learn. But you try to give them some information for their good without cost, and they think you're trying to dominate them or something. That's a big trouble. So you see, therefore, a person's got to be very careful to acknowledge anything. It calls for a thorough investigation on the whole thing from angle. If you can get down to the brass core, you at least should have some logical feel in which the thing will explain itself. If you can't do that, then the thing is no good.
Well, now, you say that I didn't read Williamson's book too carefully, as I say, but the first man that picked him up was a ham radio operator, wasn't it? Williamson went to, wasn't that his story?
No. The way I have been informed was a man in the Santa Fe ticker office that transmits your messages on ticker to the next station as the trains go by and so forth. It was in there that is supposed to have happened for the first time.
I see. Well, now Williamson is tied up with this person from Detroit, I believe.
You mean Harry Madej?
No.
Miller?
Miller.
Well, I heard Miller that day. Now, he had some good sound logic. Let us put it that way. Logic that could work in very nicely. But when a man comes out and says there's 3,500 Martian ships will save humanity, I say to him and anybody else, that's a lot of baloney.
Well, I talked this Miller out there at the convention for quite a while. He's the only one I talked to, actually, very long. And of course, they're working on this business now, this infrared light beam.
That's right. I've seen that they had those two little gadgets up there. What that is, I don't know. That's an invention or discovery, or whatever you may want to call it, of John Otto. In some way or another, I don't know anything about it, but John Otto picked it up on some great magazine at one time published, and there was a name. That part, I don't know whether it's true or not. That's what I have heard. But this infrared machine, I don't know how it works, what the results are supposed to be, or anything. That's my own analysis. If the thing was that good, our government would be long using it. Because we have technicians, I'll tell you boys something, and guided missile men, I'm not mentioning their names. I never mention names of men in any government field. The only time I mentioned names to you when I wrote you and sent the pictures when you were at the base by Mr. Thompson. He told me to use his name.
Thompson.
Yeah. But otherwise, I don't mention names at all. But I had four guided missile top men of California that interviewed me on a question of this nature. How come these spaceships can go through an atomic cloud where I have the explosion and not be affected? I said, how would I know? Well, we know you know. Well, I said, the only way a man would know would be being in one of those ships, to know just what takes place. Do you mean that I've been in the ship and I should know? We know you know. That's all they said. They would commit themselves, see? One way or the other. Well, then I told them just what the result is. And they said it was good. It's good for defense. So from there on, I won't go any further. And that's good for defense. Then they asked me, well, if I couldn't become a consultant to the guided missile job. I said, I'm no mechanic. I don't know anything about mechanics. I couldn't construct anything. I did play around with radios when they first came out, crystal sets. But that's all. And, you don't need to be a mechanic. We've got men that can do anything that you tell them. So I do know that we have men that can do most anything. See? All right. We got men that will do anything that you tell them. All we do, want your ideas. I said, that calls for wages, doesn't it, dear? I don't want to become a wage earner from the government side, because if I did, I couldn't be talking like I'm talking now. I said, I know that. I put in quite a bit of time in the service myself. I know how it works. So I said, I don't want to get tangled up there, but I'll give any information that the government wants free, without charge. That's right. But I do know, as they told me, that anything that we might conceive mentally that sounds logical can be done. We have mechanics to be able to do it. So from that angle, I would say, if this infrared machine that they have got is as good as all of that, then we'd have a better one. You see, I'm not condemning the situation. I'm only analyzing to see the inferiority that might be in there, or something that might be up to par. Okay? I give them the benefit of doubt as far as it'll go, but you just can't go to work and build up on something that really is nothing. Okay? You've got to handle it, because this, as I said, is too big a thing, and we can learn much from it ourselves. And as I say, once we learn the method of operation, and we do know that our oil is going to run out someday, and other types of things, we'll have to resort to something. We do know that man is always seeking new outlets, new adventure, and all of that. And today he set himself even beyond the saucer question, that he eventually will be traveling space and visiting other planets. And to do that, we have to find a solution, because while we may sacrifice few men in our trials, we can't keep on sacrificing all men all the time. We have to find a solution by which it'll be safe.
Well, what on this, I have two questions I picked up here while you were talking. One was, when we go to these other planets, say we go to Mars, for example, or Venus, what's our reception going to be there? I mean,
our reception is going to be good, provided we don't have no armaments.
I see. Well, why haven't these people actually physically landed here? Well, not try to colonize, let's say, but try to go out and, well, what would we do if we, well, maybe they've done this. Now, maybe this is maybe I'm answering my own question here. But the thing that we do if we go to Mars, we're going to probably pick up samples of the air and samples of the ground and various things like that. I would guess.
Well, I've been informed they have done that.
They have done that, I see.
In Canada, when I was in Canada last year, the information was received. First, I received the information by mail before I left there for Canada. So I didn't mention these men's names either. One man was doing a war, top man in the Air Force. And the other two were businessmen. And they had a little plot or land, acreage, and the weekends they go out and play around that way for their relaxation. There's a lake not far from there, and this happened on the lake. And the ship come down, and the people talk to these men. The other fellow, one businessman there, on the other hand, was having this little tractor, as he puts it, had a little disc, and he was playing around, cutting around, and getting dark, he wanted to finish a piece. He saw this thing coming in, he said, but he didn't pay no attention until his tractor died. Shut it off for him that way. And finally, he come down and talked to him. Well, in each case, they picked up soil, leaves, and water, and things like that. The same thing that you just got through saying we would do. They've done that same thing. And, of course, after the information came out, when I was lecturing there at Massey Hall in Toronto, there was a mob of people there. The place was loaded. They tell me always not to use the word loaded, because if I go to England and you say loaded, they think you're drunk. just as I got through lecturing and already through the question period, and about ready to break up, there was a lady there that had me on a radio station too, very nice person. And when three men come up on the stage also, and one tapped me on the shoulder and he says, I'm so-and-so and so-and-so. They finally got to the point that they didn't give a darn whether the public knew or they didn't. They got out and made himself known to the public. They're ones I was talking about that has happened in Canada. So this lady took him up right away. Next day, I guess after I left, they had him on the radio. But there were... One is a big businessman, got several big jewelry stores, and another fellow is in a hardware business, also with a number of stores, and this man of the Air Force, that was in the head of the Air Force, in Canada during the war. So they were men that had to be careful as to what they're going to say or hurt their business. Yet, after it come out, that body come right out, and they repeated the same thing. They says, yes, they picked up soil and cement. They were very friendly. There was no armament on the ships of any kind or anything like that.
Well, that's another question, Don. I was listening so hard, I forgot what my question was. But, Don, you were down in Mexico, and you say you talked to this one man that had also contacted
you. Oh, yes. He spent the whole night. He spent the whole night with two spacemen. And here's another thing. It was the first time of this type. The fella did have a helmet, both of them. The first one man approached him, then the other. Did have a helmet, but he carried it under his arm like this. He didn't have it on his head while talking to the man. Only time he put it on his head, which like our pilots would probably do the same thing, because it had little things on the side, he noticed, and a little small antenna on the helmet, which must have been a communication helmet, that's all. While in flight, had it on his head to come in to be in contact with his mothership or whoever he was in contact with, but not while on the ground. There's another thing that was different than any place else that was told there, right, to the government officials, because he was brought in there. And it had a belt. Now, the man had a belt too, but I'd never seen anything luminous in it at the time. Maybe he has. I've never seen it yet. But this fella had his belt, and maybe that's when they use it. They're almost identical like this. And what really happened, there was a lot of water there, and it was muddy, slushy. So they walked to the ship, and him following. He was sinking in mud up to his ankles and Bob, while they weren't. But the belt was glowing. In other words, acted as a levitator, see? And that's what he thought it did, because he didn't have it, so he saw them. But they didn't. And when they got on, they asked him to go on the ship. He was frightened. He thought of his family. He didn't know what might happen to him. But when they got on the flange of the ship, see? The flange was down at the crown. Before they get into the cabin is translucent and transparent. That's why it gives off all those different colors, because inside the ship, they have nothing but graphs, no needlework. All graphs in the color system, the various zigzag forms. One different shade, different operations of their ship, different colors go on. And actually being translucent or transparent, dome will reflect that color, and that's where you get your changes of color. So you saw all of that in there, and when they stepped up on this flange to get into the ship, he noticed that there wasn't a drop of mud or anything, debris left at all on the flange, and the flange was as shiny as a mirror. So this belt here must have been used for just walking right over the mud instead of on it. That was the oddest part of this whole thing.
I suppose that you've been asked this question 20,000 times in the past, but why doesn't somebody bring back something?
I have a letter right here. I have a piece of metal. It's not metal, it's a slack. I walked up to the ship because I had other contacts. I walked up to the ship, and I was very much surprised because on the first contact, it's a mental impression because when they have no telephone system to tell you where they want to see you. So they establish a mental communion with you because every human being has a different frequency. There's no two alike. So when you get it from a person, you know it's coming from them again because it's identical in the way it alerts you. All right. So on the second contact, brought up to the ship there, he started talking English. I was very much disturbed because he wouldn't talk English to me in the beginning. So I thought, well, I don't know what this trick is. So I can say a few words in Polish. I'm Polish on my father's side. And so I said, please, right back in Polish. So it made no difference. And this boy down here in Mexico was talking to in Spanish. He was playing around with something that he was smelling something. He had a little crucible. It was hot. You could see it was hot. And all that, and he threw some of the slack down. So I picks it up and puts it in the handkerchief. It was pretty warm, not hot enough to burn, but warm. I put it in the hanky and start sticking it in my coat pocket. He said to me, he said, what are you going to do with that? I said, well, it's a mineral of your planet, isn't it? Whatever you were doing, yes, but it's no different than your earth. The composition is the same. The only difference that they have, if there's any difference at all, is the difference of alloys. But the minerals will be the same. I said, they laugh at you. But I said, I'll take it anyway. So I brought some. Very little of it, but I brought some. One with me. So when Desmond Leslie was here, I gave him a little piece. Oh, about a piece this size. To take with him. Well, he had it already blessed by the Pope. When he was in Rome, but at least when he writes me. And anyway, but here I get a letter since I was in Mexico, while I was in Mexico, I get a letter down here that he had it analyzed by the British military. And they have, and it tells them there what it is, and there's some elements in there that are not unknown to this world.
I see.
You want to get that letter?
Let's see.
Are you
very interesting to see that.
Yeah.
Are you not going to talk?
No, I'll tell you what I'll do. While you're...
One thing I learned. Oh, meanwhile, the Air Secretary gave a little fragment to their top specialist without telling them what it was. A very long analytical report has now been made. It is marked restricted. But I have obtained a clearance to send you a copy, which I shall have made next time my secretary comes in. Briefly, though, the fragment is mainly commercial aluminum with traces of iron and other elements. It was fused at around 1,000 degrees centigrade and has some silicate on it, no doubt, through contact with the sand when hot. But there are tiny grains of some unknown substance which so far has not been analyzable. They consider that it could not have been a moving part, as it is not a strong enough metal for anything requiring stress, tension, or friction.
That's how far they made the analysis.
Very interesting. Well,
I have received some of that.
Now, our scientists say... From spectrum analysis of these different planets and the atmosphere of these different planets, that I can't keep it straight, but one of them has a carbon dioxide.
Yeah, Venus.
Venus.
Well, I'll tell you, we reason on that line. We're not going to hurt them, or we're not going to try to discredit them.
Yeah, right.
But just reason along the line. Spectrum is a wonderful thing, wonderful invention. You can put it on a piece right here and actually know the weakness of your iron. Or anything that you might want to analyze. That's very good. But since astronomers also admit that space is full of called space debris, meteorites, particles of dust, as we stated before, and gas particles of all sorts, let us then say that there's 60 million miles distance between us and planet Venus. We're going to register all of that before we hit the target. Since we don't know what percentages of interference there is between us and that body, how are we going to give a correct answer?
I see what you mean.
You see?
Right.
So therefore, what they say, like the monoxide gas on Venus, could have registered anywhere in between.
Yeah, between.
And be in the layer there all the time, any time they try it, and no matter how many times they get the same answer.
Yeah.
See? We will not know the truth until we have, and I think we are working along that line, invent what I call an electronic stick that can go out foot by foot into outer space and register each foot separately, and then register all of that, then hit the target. Then deduct all the interference that been registered prior to the hitting the target, and we have exact percentages, and then we can actually know what's on the planet.
See?
So that's the only answer we have, and then we're working along that line. And I think, according to my information from France, I have a paper on it in French, and also a letter. There's an instrument in France going into operation this month, coming month. And it's a different instrument than what we have down here, like the 200-inch. It's electronic type. They don't say what it actually is like, but it costs one-tenth of what this one costs. And actually, as they are speculating on at the moment, that will give us the answer on the conditions of each planet. That will give us the answer on the forest, water, and everything else upon the planets or bodies that we might hit. As well, they say in the course of 2 years, if it works out, then they are planning that if there was a show going on planet Venus, they could transmit it to our present TV sets.
Mm-hmm.
That's how good the instrument is supposed to be, or they're speculating on it to be. See? That would be something. But you see, our instruments are good so far as they go.
Mm-hmm.
But we do know that even the 100-inch telescope down here only goes out 1 billion light years, and 1 billion light years in the universe that has no beginning or an ending is really nothing.
Yeah. Not very far, that's right.
That's right. Because, like people say, well, it must be an end someplace. Well, let us say there was an end. There is something supporting that end which is greater than the end itself.
Yeah.
And so it goes on that way. You could argue that for now the doomsdays. And I think the word eternity expresses it very well. So you see, that's where our astronomy is today. See, for instance, we sometimes ignore, and this is an unfortunate part, we ignore of people that hadn't had much education, excluded him totally from any important job. I'm going to give you something that I happened to hit some astronomers on. I didn't mean to do it in the harming them or anything, but I just happened to question them. And I said, now, gentlemen, the 48-inch telescope on Mount Palomar down here is endeavoring to make an atlas of the sky, something that had never been done for the Geographic Society. And it's been in operation for quite some time, and it's not getting very far. And yet, this is the finest instrument ever made. But supposing that a man come to you, there were four of them, supposing a man come to you and laid out a map to count the atlas of the sky, what would you say? We'd say he was a genius. I says, but in the end, you'd ask him why he got his education, wouldn't you? Yes, we would do that. Supposing he told you he couldn't write his own name, what would you say then? Well, then we'd be wasting our time. We'd just throw the map in the wastebasket. I said, that's what I thought you would say. I said, let me say something without any harm. According to your present statement that you have made, you have admitted right here that you are, as a science, founded on what is today in modern times termed colossal ignorance. What do you mean by that, right away, spoke up? I says, just a minute. Isn't astronomy founded on the zodiac? Ancient zodiac? Yes, it is founded on ancient zodiac. Who constructed the ancient zodiac, according to history? It was a bunch of sheep herders living by night, watching the sheep, having nothing to do. They had no education. Schooling system was unknown in those days in the way it is today. But they observed the sky so well that they marked out its constellations and so forth. And, of course, anybody can make a mark like a circle and a cross and name it, if they know what they're doing. Because I can take a child, 3 years old, put him in a sand pile or younger. He will, too, make all sorts of figures with his finger. And if he wanted to name them for symbolizing this or that, he could do it. And that's what these fellows done. That's the best they could do. Yet to this day, you have not disproved them wrong. You're founded on them. Yet in modern times, because you got so far ahead of the natural laws, you would condemn a man because he had no education and it'd be impossible for him to get something like that. Yet on the first hand, you admitted he was a genius.
That's right.
I says, let's get down, I says, to basis of some common sense and work from a common sense angle and we make it some more. I said to them that. They didn't say a word to that.
Yeah.
And that's about the situation.
Yeah.
Just like I say, I really tell you to God's truth, my heart is aching for a lot of the scientists in the United States that are good men. Good men. The heart and soul is of the United States is in their being. All right, and in the States. Okay. Yet, I tell you, we import foreign scientists, give them the run of their works, and they become virtual gods among our science, while our science are ignored. Yet, let me ask you this question, and I've said it to a bunch of reporters in San Francisco. Who built up the United States to the greatness that it is today? Was our own men, our own forefathers. And the evidence are outstanding that we were desirous, truthful, forward-going peoples. Because we have gone beyond all the rest of the world. Now, if these foreign scientists are smart, why didn't they go beyond us?
Yeah.
Then why ignore our own? And they have been ignored.
Yeah.
For foreign names.
Yeah, that's unfortunately true. A foreign name in science seems to mean an awful lot to a lot of people. I don't exactly understand.
And just like some wealthy lady marries a baron or a baroness or something like that, right away something.
Yeah, that's right.
You see, that's our unfortunate side, I think. I might say right here, too, that as far as space platform is concerned, well, there's a man, I got the magazine someplace, I can give you his name, he's a scientist, German scientist, that works under von Braun and others. And when Collier's magazine published the first article on space platform, didn't find it the second one. I read them both. I didn't like it. I don't like it today. Because of this. At that time, they said it cost $4 billion. Wally laid us on this game, too. And we could build a spaceship with less money than that and go to the real space platform, which would be the moon. So this fellow was in debt. Would the magazine put his name on the front cover and all to ask my opinion? so I hid it. But I was to write my opinion to the Carter's Magazine, which I did. I have the script here. And I give my reasons for not liking the idea of a space platform, and so on and so forth, and explain it in various angles, which is nothing but the truth in the center. Well, they finally kept it for 6 months, and they sent back and they said that everything that's passed on in reference to space platform is passed by this committee, Von Braun and Wally Lay and others, Riddell and others. Well, that's all right. But I told them in this script this, why build a space platform? While we're building a space platform, Russia could be building a ship. Then as she's moving towards the moon, she could drop a small egg on us, and where are we? Well, she's at the moon. Why not build a ship and go to the moon and get a real space platform? That's what I really told him. Of course, I explained the different angles of it, and so forth and so on. Of course, that was a little bit too much truth, and we could build a spaceship for a lot less money. We have the means. We even have a spare, could build a spaceship without this excess power, and still make the moon without being sandpapered to pieces, to tissue paper. Because it was 1950, when the Admiral, Commander Edwards of the U.S. Navy come up and asked me, he said, George, would you go to work and draw me a spaceship that could travel through space? I said, yes. I'm not much of a drawer, but I can draw what I can. He said, that's all you have to do to get the rest of it. Now, what they done with that, I don't know. But anyway, I even constructed a spaceship then with a spacing between. We have several skins on the ship, see? And each skin would be spaced 4 inches for certain reasons, and your air ducts in there and all of that. Ship inside could be maintained at a proper temperature, and at the same time, all the friction would be to the outside. Of course, there'd be several skins. Maybe that one skin or two would be sandpaper down, but the rest would be all right. It was different than the rocket system. So he took that, and I understand there was a test made on a model. And as the test was made on that model, I've been told from sources I shouldn't question because I think they were true, knowing where what the position was, that it was finally tested at 10,000 Fahrenheit, and they call it finally a Frigidaire. That's how close it was back. But they did extend it. They did tell me that on the model, they extended to the 6-inch wall instead of 4 inches I had given them at first. So I do know that a ship would be made just like that, and go to the moon without any harm, without losing any lives or nothing, and make a successful trip. I do know that. And it could be done. And even then, even in an artificial form, to duplicate what the spacecraft or the saucers are doing, we can even do it now, in an artificial form. Because we can create not electrical power by a small apparatus in the ship, since they carry a lot of weight anyway. This wouldn't be even the weight that we carry today, and could create a repelling force from the skin of the ship even now and go out in a ship that way. So there's two ways we could really go right now. And so I told him, I said, I don't believe in the space platform at all when we have these opportunities to go really to the moon directly and be on a real space platform.
You say you've made contact since the one in your book, since the one out
there. Oh, yeah, I made several of them. That's what the second book is made up of.
I see.
I made several of them. And that's I might recall this again. That's how, in other words, I've been watched pretty well, I guess, at least I think I am. Due to the fact that these missile men, which are big boys, they're experts in their line, have asked me the question that they did. How come that these spaceships can go through an atomic cloud right after the explosion without being affected? How were I to know, unless they knew I had been in the ship and would have the opportunity to know how it's done? I asked them that question. They didn't confirm it or deny it. But they insisted that I knew, which I finally told them, what really takes place. And that they could understand. They had a mathematician right there. And mathematically, they figured it out. And it was correct. It should work. And it was all done for the purpose of defense. So you see, they must have known. They must watch things pretty close. Because they couldn't have not come up and be so point blank saying that you should know. How would I know unless I'd be in the ship to see how it does work?
Well, now, one other thing here, too. Of course, I've heard quite a bit about around the country about various things. Did you say a while ago that you had some of your photographs that you'd taken had been developed by machine?
Well, we got one of those booklets, haven't we?
You mean tested biometric analysis.
Of an Archer's court in England.
No, this isn't what I was referring to. I mean, it may be.
Now, Oxford University asked for pictures, too. They've got a machine like that, too. First, we were told that they want $100 for a picture for analysis of that type. And we didn't send them anything, because, heck, I had no $100 to send them for a picture. What the hell? So, this Archer's Court, Williamson Place, did the job without cost. They want to know it for themselves. Well, then after they did it, then the Oxford writes me and wants pictures without cost to do the same thing.
I see.
But the machine's supposed to do something like this. They take a picture that was not handled. What happened? You see, this is how we know. First they wrote for a picture, and we picked up any old picture down there that people have handled them. Send them out. Well, they put them in the machine, and they told us, now, it's quite a machine. They told us a lady at this and that age, that height, and this color, handled these pictures. A man of this and that. See, we can't use them. They knew exactly to the teeth. In cinema, that's what we did. And that's the analysis out of that.
I see.
Yet there's one there, or speak of one there, which is the one that shows over the, in the picture, over a, I haven't got it here, but where it's going over, disappearing over the mountain, and just on the edge of it, just like it was sitting there. Well, that one there, this is a registered stone. Well, it would register stone mineral in it, because it's been so close in the combination of magnetic influence with land.
I see.
But they even give you in there, in Cramp, did you see Cramp's book?
No.
Space, gravity, flying saucers?
No.
He's an engineer. Very good. It shows you different angles. It gives you a lot to think about on overcoming gravity. Mm-hmm. He speaks of it in there, too. Well, they went to work so far as to state how many men were in the ship at the time I talked to them, what, how tall they were, and everything, right to the teeth.
And this is the group that did it, Archer's Court.
That's
research,
right.
Group, and that's Associated with the Society of Metaphysicians.
Yeah.
Archer's Court, Hastings.
Yeah, they're the ones that did that.
I see. And then this in the back, there's, I know something.
Flying saucers?
No.
He's an engineer. Very good. It shows you different angles. It gives you a lot to think about on overcoming gravity. Well, anyhow, he speaks of it in there, too. Well, they went to work so far as to state how many men were in the ship at the time I talked to them, what, how tall they were, and everything, right to the teeth.
And this is the group that did it, Archer's Court.
That's
research,
right.
Group, and that's Associated with the Society of Metaphysicians.
Yeah.
Archer's Court, Hastings.
Yeah, they're the ones that did that.
I see. And then this in the back, there's, I know this book can be obtained through the Occult Sciences Library Service in Philadelphia.
Yeah, they got all that stuff in there.
I see.
But the University of Oxford is the one that's playing with it. Mm-hmm. And we're looking for to the analysis. See, when you photograph a ship too close, I photographed this one within 50 feet. And this is not my development or my photographers. This picture was developed by the Phoenix Gazette. And immediately when they brought it out, they said this picture was close to an X-ray machine. That's how magnetic influence was that close by range effectively. Look at it. You can see the outline, balls and all of that. The ball ending in and all of that, but it's distorted badly.
Whoops, I'm mixed up here.
Yeah,
oh, yeah.
We have already ourselves have come in to put it acknowledged ourselves. Here's an article, polio patient job, defeat gravity with a machine. We already got a machine in medical science that has already overcome gravity. Right here is an article, published in Denver in 1953.
There's quite a series of articles in Aviation Week magazine. Here about Glenn Aldrin.
52.
Somewhere along.
Drawing cartoons.
Illustrator,
see? Because there he shows what the ship looked like. Here he draws the map. This is where the landing took place.
I see.
Gives you the exact map to follow up on, and then he gives you some more here. These are another landing here, and a landing there, landing. See, these marks are all landings.
Yes.
And the other marks, the green ones in the center, about where they've been visited and what have been seen. Mm-hmm. So he's got three landings here in Argentina.
I see.
That we've heard very little about in this country.
No, I see.
Well, I do a lot of stuff. You'd be amazed.
Uh-huh.
From all parts of the world.
Uh-huh. That is. That's very interesting. I sure hope I put that thing on there right. Let me check this. Well, I realize that this is a big thing. I never, even while I was working in the Air Force, I never realized what a big thing this was in the interest in it. It just never fails to amaze me.
The interest will never fall anymore. Tell you why. Supposing the flying saucers vanished out of the sky completely. The minds of men, world over, skeptics and believers alike, have been risen from ground to the sky.
Yeah.
They'll be looking to the sky for their next venture.
Yeah. Well, I know, as I say, it's just been amazing. I've had people call me. I'll tell you an interesting little thing that I ran into here recently on this thing was this business of an odor, a real sharp, pungent odor connected to this.
Well, look, it's not such a mystery when you look at this this way. Of course, this is what happens. You heard in an Air Force, you got those reports, where sometimes there'd be something fall toward the refining the jelly bomb.
Yeah.
All compositions made up, in some way or another, they have certain amount of sulfur in them. What on earth here, when we make up butic rubber and things like that, got a certain amount of sulfur in them. In every case, this was always said that there was sulfur-like odor and an ozone-like odor. These instruments that they send out from the ships, that's for testing, just like we send out weather balloons, except these are remote control. They're anything from 20 inches to 12 feet in diameter, not piloted, those fellows are not. Mm-hmm. They send them out and they register everything in the machines and also relay them to the mothership from which they send out. They lose control of them and they blow them up in the sky, and that's where you hear an explosion once in a while. They don't want them to come to the ground intact. And sometimes they catch them a little late. So then they come down already in the disintegrating form, from solids to liquids, which is your jelly state.
Yeah.
And by the time they have a chance to pick up the darn jelly, that's gone.
That's gone.
See? And all you have is an odor.
Yeah.
That's a composition of the thing that gives off that odor. Where if a ship was to come through here right now, you could smell the ozone odor, which is electrical.
Yes.
For days thereafter. We had one come awfully close down here. Thought it was going to wreck my telescope.
I
got, and you could smell it for days through here. Very heavy ozone.
I see.
That's where those different odors come from.
Yeah, I picked this up when I went down and talked to the scoutmaster in Florida. We got burned down there. This
Sunday. You know why you got burned?
I learned it.
You can correct that in your book now if you want to.
Okay.
Which just makes really sense.
Yeah.
Really makes sense. He was either frightened or belligerent. When the ship was just over his head, he took that machete and struck at the metal. And each time, a piece of the blade broke out, which was his luck. Had it stuck in there, he would have completed the ground, completed the circuit of electrical machine to the ground and have been killed. So in order to save his own life, they shot that ray at him to get him away from there. For his own safety, that's what happened. Because you can see electrically.
Yeah.
You can get a hold of a hot wire here if you're not grounded, brother, and you can hold it.
Yeah.
But brother, when you go to work to get a hold of it and complete a circuit, you're through.
That's right.
And that's what would have happened there, see?
Yeah. It's like turning on a light and you stand in the bath and you don't want
that's
to do
right.
it.
That's right.
Right.
So you see, that was the reason that was done.
Yeah.
I learned that from them. That's
right.
I said, why did you shoot this, it wasn't the same men, but I said, why do they shoot the ray at the person like that? He says, well, if they had not, the man would have been dead.
I see.
They just frightened him enough away from there to save his own life.
Yeah.
That's what happened there. And when you analyze it yourself, then you have to do some work yourself. When you analyze yourself on the laws that we know, well, that's the only thing you could do is to save him, because the machine is electrical, as we know it. You stick that blade in there, let it stay in there. You have completed the circuit.
Yeah. Well, just as an interesting question here, since you've written your book, what does your mail run? I mean, you get quite a bit of questions.
Oh, God. We're 2,000 letters behind, and we have 300 narratives answering them.
For gosh sakes. Well, from all over the world. Mm-hmm.
I answer all of them because a lot of them are very, very scientific questions.
Yeah.
And I like to get more on some of them. I get mail from all types of scientists and everything else.
Yeah.
So really, I'm telling you, it's killing because it's costing us $100 to $150 a month for stamps and paper.
I'll be darned.
Okay. We can't answer all of them. No, we can't answer all of them. We even got a form letter that we sent out to kind of satisfy some of them. Mm-hmm. Still doesn't work.
How many different languages does your book come out in now?
It's now in about 8 or 12. I think it's about 12 now.
I see.
And it's still a contract for 8 more.
I see.
That haven't been published.
Huh.
So, but there is not a spot in the world that something hasn't been said about it, either pro or con.
Yeah.
I just like you'll be hearing this, so I'll give you the straight out. Went to Mexico. I went on it on a visit there just for a rest, and I'd never been there, so I thought I'd enjoy going to different places to see some wonderful things. They had a lot of wonderful things there. Well, the first thing that happened had been a salsa club down there that had been established by pretty wealthy people. Well, they said, "Would you give us a conference, which is a lecture, help us out a little bit?" I says, "Well, that'd be all right. I came here for vacation, not to work." And I says, "I haven't even got that kind of permit." I knew that you had to have a permit for it. They says, "We'll tend to that. Citizens of Mexico." So I said, "Okay, you see that my permit, everything for the lecture job in this theater here will be exact." I says, "You people going to charge, aren't you?" "Yes, we're going to charge to kind of get our club going. 5 pesos, that's 40 cents. I said, "Okay, when you get everything ready and everything is okay, why, I'll give you a talk." So I did. First thing, the papers, there's a funny setup in Mexico that way. When a reporter comes to see you, or what he calls press conference, you can give him all the drinks you want. He can get cockeyed drunk and eats and everything else. He still wants 25 or 30 pesos on the side. The 70 of those reporters are going to cost you a little bit. Well, that didn't happen, so they were mad in the first place. So finally, the next day, which is on a Tuesday, one of the workers says that I lectured without a permit. So then the paper down here, the papers wouldn't against me there, the way they blasted it, the whole thing, they said that I come to promote my book, and I only get a penny from that book every time it sells. Up there, the way the thing was written up and the contracts and all of that made, so what the hell do I want to promote that for? So anyhow, but that's what they said, which was not true, but they took that up as a kind of revenge. But in spite of that, the guy sold out all the books. You couldn't buy another one. In spite of that pro and con, they were opposing it. In the meantime, no problem, signed a lot of the book. And he sold out all the books. You couldn't buy another one there to save your neck. Until he got a new edition. So I was called before the immigration officer. I showed him my papers and everything else, and everything went all right. And the American consul was informed about it. And he says, "Okay." He says, "You're innocent. And if you're just an innocent victim due to the ignorance of our citizens." They thought they had everything clear, they didn't, so they called in. Mm-hmm. I was from the army, but they did say in the paper that I paid 500 pesos fine, which is $40, which I didn't. Mm-hmm. But it shows you how those papers were run, which I didn't, and nobody else did. Even those people that did make a mistake, was at fault, didn't pay. Now, the following day, I was deported. The next day, I was arrested in jail while I was at a Marriott Cristana Hotel all the time. And you should have seen the fun around there, the bellhops and everything else. "Gee, this is a nice jail you're in." All that kind of stuff. You can't bang on the table. Then the last one, which is the hardest one, 3 reporters have met me at the airport and have talked to me as I was leaving for Los Angeles. By now, I'm eating at dinner. That was Saturday night. Here I deliver a lecture to all the government big boys there on a Tuesday in a cocktail party with it. And then left Wednesday. They had me to put a set down in Los Angeles eating a dinner. So that's how far you can go with a lot of the papers. Gosh, oh, Fisher. Never seen anything like it. But anyway, then when this government conference took place, they had this El Figaro, which isn't the government. He'll publish anything for the government, and the government calls them in always, you see. So they're the only paper that works with the government. They were in there, and here we are. I'm sitting among all these big boys, and all of that in the center, and the oldest technical organization in the world, and all of that, and pictures are taken of me and the whole works here, and all of that, and that's going to be in the paper this Sunday, as it comes out weekly. This Sunday or next Sunday, if they didn't get it ready by this Sunday, then it'll be out next week. They're going to send me some of them.
Yeah.
I was wondering now, because that was a scoop for paper, what they call a scoop in this country. Mm-hmm. Would have been a scoop for them anywhere there, too.
Yeah.
But you see, because they misbehaved, the government ignored them completely. When this little paper comes out with that stuff, what a holler is going to be there. Isn't it? And isn't it? Stick their necks out so darn funny.
Yeah.
Savvy.
Oh, they're... I know newspapers are odd, and then foreign newspapers are worse, I think. They get all loud.
I asked some of the newspaper outfits, what sort of a journalist school do you go to? Well, at journalist school, you learn all about journalism. I said, it must be pretty doggone bad, because you've been sensible before. You at least adhere to points, but now you don't. You misconstrued everything. You never give the thing straight anymore.
Oh, golly.
I asked some reporters down in San Francisco, down there, and by the way, this gentleman, you might know him, everybody was shaking in their boots, thinking that he might come up there, shut the lecture off of the U.S. Ordnance Department. And he says to me, he says, Joey, don't worry. He says, we can't support you in point blank outside, but he says, I'll tell you one thing. The Air Force and the Army is behind you. This fellow here, maybe you know him.
No.
No?
No, I don't believe I know him. No, I know him. San Francisco Ordnance District.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I know the San Francisco Ordnance District. I don't have the name of the gentleman.
This is the man that came out.
No?
And he's very nice. But anyhow, I said to the reporters then, I said, now look, what are you working, who are you working for, Russia or United States? I said, all the publicity you have given to Russia,
yeah.
If she had to buy that darn publicity here, she would have been broke long ago.
Yeah, that's very true.
I says, and I says, your father, the technique too. And he says, well, no, we don't. I says, the heck you don't. I says, you claim that Russia, if they want to put a finger on a man, they just put a finger on him, publicize him a lot. By the time he gets to the court, he's already condemned. The court can't do anything else but convict him. You do the same thing. You never get to show the other side. What are you talking about? I said, who are you working for? I got a little irky. Well, but that's the situation.
The way it goes, yeah.
You know? And I got it in the other. I'll show you some of the men that I met in Mexico.
Very nice. Did you go with me down there?
It's really nice, I'm telling you, beautiful.
Yeah.
The weather is marvelous. Of course, they're expecting rain season now for the next 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But it was beautiful. At night, you sleep with just one sheet.
Huh.
Beautiful,
yeah.
Very even climate.
Yeah.
I've never been there before, but I really like it.
Here's
the gentlemen, some of them, right here that you can read who they were, and here I've got some private cards of theirs. And I even got a pass to go any place I want in Mexico, government, arsenals, anything.
Yeah. Director of Federal... Electorate or something. My Spanish is absolutely worthless. Vice President Association.
And that's Navy and Army and Astronomy.
Yeah.
Air Force.
Very interesting.
Here's some of the cards. Guzman, that's the fellow that was a translator for me that
saw
in the picture.
Uh-huh.
The federal man. And this is the pass. This is this fellow next to the president. That's his pass, see?
Yeah.
I can take that card any place in Mexico, go to any federal building or any place else. They really treat you nice, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
You see, they all have a federal stamp on there.
Mm-hmm.
And even a private address is given to me. No, I've met around a lot of nice people. And this fella is a man. Actually, in general, he's in English.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Them are the people that are responsible for the lecture that the rescue was messed up.
Oh, I see.
They should have known better, people in that position.
Yeah.
But it really, it brought a lot of things that I wouldn't have learned otherwise had it not been a mistake made.
Uh-huh.
I've really learned wonderful things there.
Well, Jim, when Jim went to South America, where was it? Someplace you lost your shot record, and they had to give you shots all over again before they let him into...
Oh, yeah, that was in Panama.
In Panama.
Uh-huh.
He had to take all his smallpox shots over again a week after you take them.
Well, you've got to be vaccinated going to Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Going in is not bad. Mm-hmm. It's coming back.
Yeah,
he's very careful. Yeah. You've got to be vaccinated.
Yeah. No, I've never been to Mexico. Well, of course, I've been across the border.
I'm telling you, you'll be amazed more than anything. And it isn't bad. Look, I was there 14 days. It cost $129. Of course, the girls picked me up at the airport this time coming in. Otherwise, it would have been $3. It would have been $132. That's round trip. That's a bus trip from Hotel Grand to the airport, Tijuana, and back again, and the transportation on DC 6. That's the best plane to go. A nice trip. It's 5.5 hours. And this is the riding. I left here at 4:00 in the afternoon, so naturally went over partly daylight setup, and then dark. They serve you chicken dinner on the ship. And all the cocktails of any type you want. Beer, anything. Jack Bain, anything. It'll serve you right on through. Coming back, of course, I left there in the morning and arrived at 12 down here. And there's 2 hours difference. The trip is cheap, so that was $32. And the hotel room for all that time of 14 days was 600 pesos, which is just a little over, around $50 for 14 days. That's more than full 2 weeks. And you eat, well, you can buy the best kind of dinner, 4-5-course dinner, for $1.40. I got a haircut there for 8 cents. One peso.
Yeah.
That's 8 cents.
Yeah.
Have my suit cleaned and pressed, and really wonderful job, better than you get it through here, with 8 cents, one peso. Thing like that, you see.
Yeah.
You can take a couple of $100, go in there, live a month very nicely, and enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
See a lot of things. But what is the most amazing up there is the beautiful buildings, magnificent buildings, glass. There's one building down there is the greatest glass building in the world, the only one of its kind, all glass in here.
Huh.
And yet all the buildings are built on pillars, most of the new buildings. All modern, no two alike.
Mm.
And the pillows are that concrete pillars, they're that big around, underneath 10 to 12, up to 20 feet off of the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And still they don't utilize that underneath.
Mm-hmm.
Engineering is really something.
Mm-hmm.
They don't utilize that. You would think they would maybe have it for a garage or a parking car or something. But most of them are a lawn or something like that, nice park around it and so forth, and empty underneath.
Mm-hmm.
And here's these big pillars holding these buildings up. And they're 14, 20-story buildings.
Yeah, amazing.
On those pillars.
Uh-huh.
I could never figure out why they do that. Maybe a party did say to me that the reason they do it, they got a ball-like socket in the ground, quite deep in the ground, in case of an earthquake. They allow the building to go so far, and the socket catches it and throws it back. That may be it. But so many of them like that, all the new ones.
Huh.
And beautiful setups, no kidding.
Did you get to travel out and see the various sites around?
Yes. I went to a place, I have some postcards here. This is what they call a floating garden.
Yes,
I've
heard of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You heard about it?
Floating garden? I've heard of it. Yeah.
Well, this is the postcard here.
Oh, I see.
It's wedded like that.
Yeah.
See?
I see.
Here's a bridge like that over it and all of that. I went out to those places. You'd be riding in one of these. See, let's see if we can see a small one here. There's a small one there. Riding along these, maybe you get a better one here, maybe. Boy, one person there, and I think this one here. See, there's a small one.
Yeah.
One of them will be come along, about this narrow, and about as long as from here to that wall, and a woman would be kneeling down on her hunches there, sitting down on her hunches, and she'd be peddling flowers.
Uh-huh.
See, sell flowers. Come right alongside the bigger ones, peddling flowers. Or a big one would come along with a whole band.
Yeah.
They'll ask you to play, and they play, or any kind of orchestra you want.
Yeah.
Next, you'll come along, a jewelry or pocketbooks, and try to sell it to you. Just come right along there.
Uh-huh.
And then the next one will come along, just a dark on a little pad like this, of a plate on it, and charcoal burning underneath, right in the boat, and down a little bitsy boat, and only that high, that deep. And she's kneeling down here. You can get a handbook, a steak, anything you want, right there, one side of the boat.
Mm-hmm.
And this in here, this part here, see, there's a part of a restaurant,
uh-huh.
And right down below here, right down where this light is, that's going way down.
Right.
See, this is the upper floor. You come in from the top here, and you come in here, and then there's another big section, like there's a lot of tables.
Mm-hmm.
You can get a dinner in there for $1.25, all you can eat. And the soups are out of this world, I'm not kidding you. And then if you go down around here, there's steps going down there, and it's about 20 feet lower than this.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a big opening there. It's originally a volcanic cave, but it is. See, this is all volcanic.
Yeah.
And it's all open to the side here, never closed up. And I guess when it rains, they just don't operate, that's all.
Uh-huh.
And all the kitchens in those little smaller caves and so forth. But down here, where this light shines on, it gives you a funny feeling because here's the Aztec dancers. They come out and dance on the platform, get to the music, and the light is shining right on them. It's really making a very odd setup.
Uh-huh.
Very beautiful. That's near the pyramids.
Uh-huh.
Those big pyramids.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You go out to see the pyramids, and then the next thing you go down to this restaurant, a little ways from the pyramids is this restaurant. And then the university, what they call a university city, the biggest campus, university campus in the world, they say. And beautiful pictures, all this type of mosaic work. on the buildings, library and all of that. Oh, it's beautiful.
Uh-huh.
The stadium is the largest in the world.
Uh-huh.
That's where they had all the doings, so I think a Pan-American...
Oh, Pan-American track meter.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's where they had it. Yeah, I went there one day. Uh-huh. And it's the biggest stadium in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Beautiful, I tell you. Hey, most of that stuff is built of lava rock.
Uh-huh.
It's all lava rock, everywhere you look. So they really got the goods up there, and they're really building up very modern and very artistic. It seems to every time they build something, they build so much art with it.
Uh-huh.
Art seems to be the predominant in the buildings and all of it. Really beautiful. The people are very free as far as talking. They're kind of suspicious in their way because an Indian is a character that we're even through here.
Uh-huh.
He won't talk till he knows you well. Then when he opens up, he really talks.
Jim lives with
his best friend.
Apaches for a couple of years. He knows how they are.
Yeah, well, it's about that same way you will find up there. Yet you go out in the outskirts there. Now, the government can't do nothing with those people at all. Mm-hmm. There are a bunch of Indians that are satisfied with one row of beans and one row of corn and one row of this for themselves, and that's all. And you look up on them, they're an awfully poor class of people. But they just don't want to be helped.
Yeah,
the government would help them there. Would like to develop because Mexico is very low in its agriculture, and they like to develop the agriculture. They're striving for that.
Mm-hmm.
But the people won't do it. There's 33 million people in there, only about 7 million people that are doing anything.
Yeah.
The rest of them are laying around, doing nothing. It just won't work.
No,
but it's really worth going in, I'm telling you. Mexico City is really beautiful.
Yeah.
Plus, the Acapulco and all through there are still more beautiful, but they're more or less our actual resort.
Mm-hmm.
And you see those doggone walls. Walls 14, 15, 20 feet high. Whole blocks encased in it.
Uh-huh.
And some of them look kind of ugly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you get behind those walls.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful homes and vegetation and mansions.
Uh-huh.
Well, I suppose we have their body
most,
more here.
Most everybody talks English.
Huh.
Yeah. You didn't have any trouble at all.
No trouble at all. I don't understand a word in Spanish. I can't say a word in Spanish. They got a long time.
Yeah.
Only places in the lecture, and then I had a translator.
Uh-huh.
But otherwise, gosh, you can go any place.
Yeah.
Now in the drugstore up there, there was a Chinaman running. Old, very clean, slick up to date. Drugstore, I wanted some shaving cream and some razor blades I'll run out of already. I went in there and asked for it to talk English. Only one place I went in there and tried to get soap. And that's a big department store. And the girls behind there didn't know what I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I pointed out, it's a Lux soap, bar soap. But, boy, you just got a lot of money.
Yeah.
You tip five pesos, it's $5 to them.
Yeah.
But to you, it's only 40 cents.
Yeah.
Makes you feel like a big spender, doesn't it?
It does, no kidding. Because you have so little on yourself, you know that. You're limited, too.
Yeah.
Yet here you get so doggone much. For every $10 that you cash in of American money, you get 124 pesos. You don't mind, you realize that there's a nice job for you and one thing, so you give them $5, $10, their money. To you, it's only 40 or 80 cents.
Yeah.
And it's nothing for us to drop a dollar for a tip here.
Yeah,
see? So if you drop a dollar there, it's really $12 to them.
Yeah.
Oh.
It gives you a satisfactory feeling because they do appreciate their old pesos. And to you, of course, it doesn't mean much. You're really not going on and being a big shot. You're more or less normal.
Sure.
In the meantime, they think you're doing them a lot of favor because they can so much. Well, you go for all day in a taxi, private taxi that takes you out. There's 1,000 taxis in Mexico City or more, and they're all owned privately by individuals. You spend a whole day. They take you out in the morning by 9 o'clock, and by 5:30 and 6, they bring you back. 30 pesos.
Well, yeah, I spent a year over in India during the war, and we all had our own private valets over there, our own men servants, you know. And that was real funny, too. We paid them $12 a month is all we paid them. And I had this kid, and they actually lived right outside your door. They slept on the ground right outside your door. And I got swelled over there. My wife always kidding me about it. She'll say, well, you think you're still an Indian, you know. Because they just waited on your hand and foot, you know.
They do that same thing here. There's a couple come in there with two little kids. Well, they want the time to themselves. So they got this girl, a Mexican girl, to take care of the kids. So they give us so much money, you know, so much pay, so many pesos. She right away took the taxi with the kids, took the kids out to a park.
Yeah.
None of that. Hey, we're free.
Yeah.
And all they pay them is maybe $5 a week.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that's 5 pesos a week.
Yeah.
That means 40 cents.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, you can say, down there, I wanted to go to Guadalajara, but I was so darn busy with all of this once got to go, and I couldn't get nowhere. I'm going to go back, though. And that's where all the Army and Navy officers of the United States are settled. You know, on pensions, you know, you get a pension, $150, $200 a month, the way things are here, you eat it up before you know it, and you're in debt. There. You just figure that, 12 times that.
Yeah.
Well, they live like kings. They got help and everything else, and they live like a king.
Yeah.
There's a lot of them, they say, have been Guadalajara and Poco Poco, all kinds of Americans, and mostly American settlements.
Yeah.
Well, Rufe, I think we better go.